May it please the court. My name is Jerry Van, and I'm the attorney for Appellant SS in this case. My associate, Larry Holtis, is the attorney for Appellant LH. Mr. Holtis, unfortunately, last night became very ill and could not make the hearing this morning, but we agreed that with the court's permission that I would handle the oral argument for both parties.
Absolutely, that's fine.
Because the facts of this case are so important to the appellant's appeal, I want to highlight just quickly a few critical facts. The first being that the baby in this case was born September 13th, 2011, and she had a congenital swallowing defect at birth, and she had episodes of spitting up and coughing and periods where she appeared to be stopped breathing or holding her breath. But that congenital condition was not caused by anything the appellants did. Second, the parents never sought to conceal the baby's condition. In fact, they took her to the doctor twice in the first 9 months of her life when the swallowing problem became apparent. Third, during the 9 days when the parents actually had physical custody of this child, there were always at least three adults present in the house when the baby was there. Fourth, there was no other evidence that accounted for the child's broken ribs other than the CPR that the father had attempted when the baby had a choking incident. And on that occasion, there were five other adults in the house besides the two appellants when that CPR was done. Turning now to the issues presented for appeal, I've listed seven errors. With the time problem, I'd like to cover just three main arguments. The first argument pertains to the testimony of the department's expert witness, Diane Baird, which we believe should have been ruled inadmissible by the court. When Ms. Baird was first identified on the department's witness list, neither the department nor the GAL, who offered the witness's testimony at the trial, provided a report or a summary of the witness's testimony provided by or required by Rule 26.
Let me stop you there. Yes. What else does Rule 26 say? Doesn't it exclude juvenile?
I think there's an argument that it does. Yes.
I read. It's otherwise ordered by the court, stipulated by the provisions of this rule shall not apply.
And I think that
it's excluded unless.
Correct. I made an argument. I felt that I was right up until the end, but when I saw that explanation, I felt maybe that's true, and maybe that's the response here.
I mean, just to clarify, the parties didn't stipulate nor did the court order that this rule apply.
No.
Okay.
No. The only point that I want to make, and the only critical point here, is that when the department provided their witness list, and I filed a motion in limine objecting to Ms. Baird's testimony, and the court then ordered Ms. Baird to be made available so that my associate counsel and I could question her regarding her possible testimony, we only had 2 days left before the trial was to start. There was no opportunity to depose her. There was no time to secure a rebuttal witness, which would have been very important to us. And we were caught completely by surprise when we learned of her prospective testimony. You have to see the context of this case. This child was taken from her parents, right from Denver Children's Hospital, and placed in a foster home. And it was not until December of that year that the parents began having every other week, 1 hour supervised parenting time. And under those circumstances, there was absolutely no rapport built up, no bond between the parents and this child. And when the child was brought to the department offices by the foster mother, she was generally taken into a small confining room like a cell, handed to the parents, and then videotaped to see what happened.
Mr. Yes. Ben, didn't you argue this or present evidence about this during the trial?
Yes.
Or in cross-examination?
Yes,
of the witness, the expert witness?
Yes.
And so would this not go to the weight of the evidence to be determined by the jury in this case? Was there a jury? I can't remember.
There was a jury.
I think
yes,
there was a jury.
An adjudicatory jury trial.
Yes. It would go to the weight of the evidence, would it not?
I think, in my view, the witness never should have been allowed to testify. Because,
I want to follow up. What exactly did she say to the jury in her testimony?
She looked at two videotapes. Of two visitation sessions, and she essentially said to the jury, "I can tell you, by looking at these parents and the child's reaction, I can tell you who damaged this child."
And how old is the child?
The child at that time was only about 3 months old.
Okay.
I can look at that child, look at the parents and the way the child reacts, and I can tell you who hurt that child, and that that child knows who hurt her, and in effect, who abused her. To me, that was so incredible, and that's what I say when my associate counsel and I found out that that's what she was going to say. We said, "This is voodoo science. This is like looking in a crystal ball and telling the jury, I have expert qualifications, but I'm going to tell you who abused this child." And I'm going to tell you, just by looking at these two videotapes, who abused this child. And it was...
And how did that impact the jury?
I'm sorry.
You say it's voodoo. How did that impact the jury? There was certainly other evidence.
There was other evidence, but that, to me, that had a very a telling effect, just because of the way it was presented. The GAL puts on a video in front of the jury, one video of about 20 minutes worth of crying. This child is brought into this room, handed to her parents. She starts to cry, and the parents then try to quiet her. They're not able in this videotape to quiet her or to soothe her, and then she's taken out of the room and given back to the foster mother. And then right after that, Ms. Baird's testimony comes on and essentially says, "See, I can tell you by the way the father is holding the child, or I can tell you by the way the mother is holding the child. She's not holding her close enough. She's holding her away from her. I can tell you that this child knows this parent abused her."
She was qualified as an expert?
She was.
In what?
I don't recall at this moment exactly.
Did you object to her expert qualifications or question her background before she was qualified?
I don't recall exactly. I don't recall challenging her qualifications. My objection from the beginning, from the time that I filed a motion in limine, went to the content of her testimony.
Uh,
I'll go on to the second error, and that involved the department's caseworker testifying over the appellant's objections regarding three documents from a court in California. And those documents, which are specifically identified in our brief on page 16, pertain to events that occurred in 2007 and 2008, one of which was an amended petition concerning allegations, not proven facts, but allegations of parental wrongdoing in that DNN case in California.
That would be the petition.
Yes.
About the order of disposition in an order terminating the parental rights to CS. We move beyond allegations there, don't we?
There's some orders there, but they're all based back on what I say is the very telling and constitutionally infirm document from which the department witness testified, quoting hearsay statements an allegation in a petition that were not proven facts, and relating those to the jury as though they were facts in this case.
I will grant you that I think the petition is different than the orders, but with regard to the orders, if we can separate those out, wouldn't they fall within the public records exception of the hearsay rule?
I think they were. I think because they were authenticated, they did come under the public records exception.
So,
I objected to the amended petition.
Okay, I wanted to follow up on that and to follow up on what Judge Roman was saying. In the order of disposition and in the order of termination, did that not include very similar facts that were stated in the petition?
I would say no.
Okay.
There was a reference back in one.
They didn't talk about broken bones, those kinds of things?
There was a reference to broken bones in one of the orders.
So can we say it's harmless if we agree with your argument on the petition?
I'm sorry, but
if we agree that admitting the petition was error, can we not then say it's harmless if we say the order of disposition and termination was not error?
No, I don't think you can, because that amended petition, the court essentially, I objected to the witnesses testifying about stating what the amended petition said to the jury as though it was fact and not her testimony.
Social worker,
and then
you're talking
judge
about.
Essentially said, well, I agree she shouldn't be testifying about that, and I'm going to instruct the jury to strike that, but I'm going to let that document in so that the jury can read it and form their own opinions. So yes, the jury is given a document that has all of this hearsay in it, hearsay on hearsay, when it's testified to by the department's witnesses. And to me, that was extremely prejudicial to leave that.
And you indicated you had 3 points to make, and you have a minute and 15 left.
Yes. I'm just going to quickly say the third error that we pointed out is on page 19 to 21 of our brief. Involved some a police officer from the Tucson Police Department who testified regarding his investigation of two deaths of two children of the appellant SS. One occurred in 1998, the other occurred in 2001. Neither of those, the evidence did not show that SS was responsible for the deaths of either of those parties. No charges were ever filed in those cases against SS over the deaths of his two children. It was tragic that they died, but it was not relevant evidence. In fact, it was prejudicial evidence, as far as my argument is concerned, to bring that up in front of the jury.
object to it at trial? What was the basis for the trial court? Not relevant.
I don't honestly recall. I know that I objected to it, and I know that the court overruled my objection.
I see your time is up, but I have a question on the record here. You objected to this testimony by motion before trial. Is that correct? And somewhere, did the judge hold a hearing on that?
Yes.
Do we have a transcript of that hearing?
I believe you do.
Do you recall the date of that hearing?
I'm thinking of a different... I don't know whether that's in the record or not. It should be part of the record, because...
Well, there's a lot of shoulds, but I was trying to figure out if it was, because I wasn't able to locate it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But it's hard to decipher exactly when the court ruled on that. Do you recall?
As I recall, there was only one hearing, because I filed a motion in limine, and then I filed a supplemental motion in limine, because the department sought to offer another piece of evidence that I objected to.
That was all heard at a particular hearing?
Yes, it was. It was. And if it's not part of the record, I'm very surprised that it's not.
Well, I see you're out of time, but I've had to clarify that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Kern. My bar number is 42694, and I represent the Department of Human Services from Archuleta County and the people of the state of Colorado. Sitting at council table is Ms. Susan Street, whose bar number is 22689. She represents the special interveners, the foster parents, and is here today. Though I do not expect her to address the court, if the court has any questions as to how the child is doing or its development as to this point, then she's here to offer that. In a dependency neglect case, the best interest of the child is of paramount concern. And in this case, the record does not reflect errors that so undermine basic fairness of trial as to cast doubt on the reliability of the judgment. And especially in this case, given the arguments that the opponents put forth, the effect and weight of evidence, as well as the inferences and conclusions, are within the discretion of the trial court, and the trial court should not be disturbed on review if it is supported by the record. Now, in this case, the evidence, when viewed as a whole and in light most favorable to the people, is sufficient to support the jury's verdict.
Counsel, with you, I actually want to start where we ended, because I'm very curious, as my colleague, I believe, is, as to what happened with regard to the testimony of the deaths of the two children. Apparently, there was a hearing, but we don't have a transcript or a record of it. What's your recollection of what happened, if you can, without going outside of the record before us?
Yes, Your Honor. From my recollection, at the pretrial conference when these motions were heard, the judge ruled that, and I specifically remember these words because it struck me, that all parenting is relevant. A person's parenting history is all relevant, which I think case law supports. Now, I can't tell you what date that pretrial conference was held. I cannot tell you much more about that, other than that the court heard it.
But you don't know if we have a record of that.
I know that the hearing was held. I do not believe the transcripts were ever requested from that hearing. If I may, I would. There are seven different issues, and I would like to address at least the ones that, if time allows, that counsel addressed. And I'll start with the one that we just started with. The evidence of the two infant deaths were not introduced to show that SS was responsible for their deaths or had been charged with a crime for their deaths. Rather, and I believe the testimony from every witness that touched on this, was that those deaths were suspicious and that the cause of death eventually became unknown. With the second child, she was ruled right off the bat as an unknown death. With the first child, Alicia, her death was initially ruled as SIDS, but upon notification from our department to the Pima County Sheriff's Department. The Detective Holly, who testified at trial, reopened her case, asked the coroner to look at her report again, and ruled that because she was sitting, one of the reasons he gave at trial was that because she was sitting upright in a car seat, that SIDS was highly unlikely, and his testimony, although it was objected to, was that that was suspicious and that they changed the ruling.
So what's the relevance?
The relevance, Your Honor, goes back to what I believe Judge Lyman ruled, is that all parenting is relevant, and I believe, or at least the prior history of parenting is relevant, which I believe case law supports.
But how does that go to parenting? That goes to police investigation and a suspicion of criminal activity.
Yes, Your Honor. I think if that was the only bit of parenting history that we had, the relevancy would be much less. However, Your Honor, there is at least six children within the history of this family that have either been harmed or have been, the parental rights have been terminated, and then these two suspicious deaths. And these were infants within the very first parts, few months of their lives, and that showed extreme relevance on the fact that we have a 9-day-old or 10-day-old infant who within those first 10 days of her life had 9 fractured ribs. And so I believe, and I believe the trial court agreed, that that evidence was relevant in showing that some sort of parenting history for SS. I also believe that opponents argue that the evidence presented was unfair and unduly prejudicial, and it misled the jury. And again, I would point the court to the records and the testimony of the witnesses that specifically said that he was never charged with that crime. It was just that they were suspicious. Now, I'd like to work back to Ms. Diane Baird and her testimony, and to answer one of the questions posed. Ms. Diane Baird was qualified as an expert in early childhood attachment and evaluation of parent-child relationships. The department also argues that Rule 26 does not apply. It is explicitly stated in that rule. However, Ms. Diane Baird was disclosed through the witness lists, and the essence of her testimony was disclosed on February 3rd. The appellants were given all access to all videos. They were given access to Ms. Baird to interview, including at trial when it became known that she had actually viewed a second videotape.
So she was, I'm sorry to interrupt, she was disclosed on February 3rd, and when was the trial?
The trial began, I believe, February 26th or 25th. So the appellants had noticed that she would be testifying, and the witness disclosures also included her contact information. Now, besides being able to speak to her a second time at trial before she testified, the appellants were prepared enough to have photos of the visits that they presented to her actually on the stand, and Ms. Baird's qualifications were unquestionable.
So you disagree that this is voodoo science?
You know, I believe that would be a question for the jury, not me. I believe that her opinion was that the minor child suffered trauma and that she associated that trauma with her parents. Now, Ms. Baird also qualified her testimony by stating that she...
A three-month-old child and how a child reacted to being held by the parent?
Again, Your Honor, I believe that that is a question for the jury, and that it's not a question for me to ask or to draw a conclusion on. I would point to the specific nature of her testimony.
There was a scientific basis for her testimony?
I believe that her basis for her testimony would be her personal experience, her expertise. She has written curriculum for the court. She has trained on this. She does this as a matter of what she does for a living. And again, appellants never objected to her being qualified as this expert. Again, her opinions were specific, consistent, even when presented with those photographs. And also, I would again reiterate that she qualified her statements by saying not only that she had never witnessed the interactions in person, but that she undoubtedly felt that she had no doubt that the parents loved their child. It's just that the child associated that trauma with them.
I want to back up just a little bit, Mr. Kern, and ask you, how long in advance of trial did you have this expert's opinion in your office?
Your Honor, because she had not actually viewed the videotape until closer to trial, I believe it was relatively close to trial before we knew what her specific opinions would be. I would say within 2 weeks of trial, that we knew essentially what her testimony would be. Now, I have to be careful here and be careful of what I represent, because this was the GAL's witness, who and she is not here, obviously, today to discuss that. I believe the appellants are attacking the credibility of Ms. Diane Baird, which I believe goes to the sole credit to the purview of the jury, and I do not believe that it should be disturbed on review. Now, the other point to point out with that is that the jury were able to see the rooms. They were able to actually visit the rooms to see how cramped they were, if they were, and I believe that helped the jury in understanding what occurred in those rooms.
What rooms are you talking?
The rooms at the Department of Human Services, which are essentially offices. We have very limited resources. And
the video was taken?
So where the videos were taken, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And where other visits had occurred that had not been videotaped. Now, the second portion that, the second argument that Mr. Finn was able to touch on today was the California documents that were included by the testimony of Ms. Shauna Stewart. And they are correct that they were self-authenticating documents that were introduced. Judge Lyman gave, not only said, stated and ruled that the jury could take from them what they would, but he also gave limiting instructions before each and every one of them. Specifically, the first one, which is, though it's slightly titled differently, which is the petition independency and neglect. He stated that that the jury was to disrespect or disregard any representation of the injuries that petition spoke to. Now, the appellants do argue that the due process rights were violated, then they go to the bifurcated analysis of whether or not, one, there is a protected interest, and if there is, then to evaluate the adequacy of the process that is being challenged. It is our opinion and our position today that their due process rights were absolutely protected. Though they may not have had a person from California to discuss these, to confront on the witness stand concerning these documents, they were given their, presumably, their due process rights in California when this case occurred. And it is also important to note that this was not a trial concerning what occurred in California. It was rather a trial about another child of the parents who was presenting with similar injuries.
So how was the petition relevant?
I believe the petition was relevant because it showed that over a course of time, within the short five and a half months of that child's life, she suffered multiple fractures, all that were at different stages of healing, which indicate a continual pattern of either abuse or trauma, depending on what the California courts found.
Again, what did the judge, how did the judge advise the jury on that?
When Ms. Shauna Stewart began to testify about what was in the petition, the allegations, i.e. the specific injuries that were sustained, Mr. Vinn did object, and the judge ruled that the jury was to disregard anything that Ms. Stewart said concerning the injuries, that they were simply allegations, and that was it. Now, going back to the due process analysis.
So now I want to follow up my question again. How is it relevant?
I believe it's extremely relevant because we have a child from the same parents who within 5.5 months were suffering these injuries.
But I thought the judge said to disregard the injuries. You're wanting it admitted for the purpose of what the judge said you're not to consider.
I see.
So that's why I'm confused here.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the relevancy of that petition was that an action had been initiated in California, and that was the initiating document. Now, going back to maybe to assuage some concerns concerning that petition, seeing how they were just allegations, the appellants are arguing that they did not have an opportunity to confront this evidence. However, they both extensively testified as to this document and as to what occurred in California, including describing what those injuries were, that they were at different stages of healing, and ultimately the conclusion of that case, which was the termination of their parental rights. So I believe that if there was error in admitting the petition, because it did contain allegations that had not yet, as far as the timeline for those documents, been ruled on, the testimony of the appellants made it a harmless error, if there is even an error.
Sure. Kern, let me ask you, I have here what's labeled as Exhibit 1. It's an Archuleta County Department of Human Services court report dated April 2nd, 2012, filed in the court. Was that admitted into evidence? Do you know? Exhibit 1?
Exhibit 1, Your Honor, I would believe not, because the trial took place on February of 2012. So that would have had to have been post-trial. Now, it may have been, and the date escapes me when the dispositional orders were entered. It may have been presented for that purpose, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If question for you, not related to.
Okay.
Seeing. Goes towards a procedural piece. Talking a lot of. There was a disposition. My understanding of the disposition is that the parents requested a treatment plan and an opportunity to be reunited, or in the alternative, that they support a placement of the child with relatives as a less drastic alternative of termination. And my understanding is after the dispositional hearing, the court found that there was no appropriate treatment plan. What happened with the parent request of placement of the child with relatives as a less drastic alternative to termination?
Yes, John, I believe there's possibly two different issues here. One, the parents were actually living with the paternal grandparents when the injuries occurred. Because of the fact that the appellants or any other family members were very secretive in any discussions with the department on what occurred. In fact, we did not find out about the eyewitness until witness disclosures were made on February 3rd. Therefore, because we knew the injuries occurred in the home, the paternal grandparents were, in our opinion, ruled out for appropriate placement at the time.
Well, did the judge make that finding?
Yes, Your Honor, the judge did make that finding. We made that actual argument from the very beginning, from the shelter hearing on.
When did the judge make that dispositional hearing?
Your Honor, I would respectfully direct you back to the record because I don't know if I could represent correctly when that was. I do know that question had been brought up specifically to the paternal grandparents, and that was dealt with at the shelter hearing and was reiterated at each hearing thereafter, and the judge did make those findings. The second portion of that is the as for a less drastic alternative, my understanding of the statutes is that is that can be in place of a termination or after the termination as far as placement considerations go, whether you place with kinship or you place with foster care families. And because of the filing of the appeal, we have not approached that. I see that I'm out of time.
That's fine. No, Finney.
Because of the filing of the appeal, the termination hearing has been waylaid, and so until that occurs and until there is a termination order, if and when there will be, then we'll be making the appropriate decision whether or not kinship placements versus foster care placements for permanency are appropriate. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That